So I will give the last experimental talk, last set of experimental facts before the panel will then explain to us what it all means. And unlike some of the other speakers, I know exactly why I'm here, because I've been avoiding Krishna at MIT for about a year or so, because I know that every time I run into him, he wants to know the latest status of the event-by-event fluctuations. And well, now I've been cornered, so I'll use the catchy title that he provided for me, Fluctuations Experiment, and give you a survey of the event-by-event results that have been appearing over the last couple of years. Okay, so I must add a disclaimer. I will restrict my this survey to a particular subset of event-by-event results, and what I will look at is global fluctuations of intensive variables. So I will not go into the connection between event-by-event fluctuations and correlations. I will look at the fluctuations of observables where you take your, essentially the acceptance of your detector and average some intensive variable like mean, like the PT or like the ratio of k-ons to pi-ons over this acceptance. And what I'll do is I'll try to summarize what we know about the energy and centrality dependence of such observables. And towards the end, I'll add some mild speculation on what that might mean. So event-by-event fluctuations, I mean, the basic question is, I take a bunch of events. I mean, here I have four. Star has, 10 million on tape. And what you want to know is, are these events, when you take one and compare to the next one, are they different or are they the same? So is there a dynamical difference, a non-statistical difference between the events, or is this all the same? I mean, if you look closely, these four are the same actually. So in my talk, I have sort of three tasks. First I have to define how experimentally we tell whether the events are different or are the same, whether there is a non-statistical difference between them. Then I'll briefly remind you what kind of physics would make such events more different or more the same, and then we'll see what the data actually tell us. So let me just try to explain these two words, global and dynamical, again, and I'll use the words dynamical and non-statistical synonymous. So global means that for an example of, say, the transverse momentum, what I do is I take the transverse momentum for each particle in a given event, I sum them up, I actually divide by the multiplicity, and that gives me for every event the mean transverse momentum of the event. And then I study how that mean transverse momentum per event varies from event to event. And to decide whether this variation is dynamical or statistical, what I do is I compare the variance of the distribution I get to some statistical reference. And how this is done, I mean, this is essentially a computer version of the hand-drawn diagram that Misha had. Basically, what you start out with is the inclusive, say, PT distribution. And this inclusive distribution can be characterized by a width here. And then if your particles were drawn individually, independently from this probability density function, then the event-by-event mean PT function would have a variance that's just given by the width of the inclusive distribution squared divided by the mean multiplicity. And that's essentially what the central limit theorem tells you. And so if we take this inclusive variance divided by the average multiplicity, then that gives us our estimate of the statistical fluctuations. And then what we do is we, for every event, calculate the mean PT, fill it into a different histogram, get the variance of that, and the difference between these two is what we call dynamical fluctuations. And the global is because we've taken this variable and averaged it over the whole acceptance of the detector. Okay. So, I mean, obviously this is our object of interest, the QCP phase diagram. And I mean, something I want to remind you is that there's really a lot of promise in event-by-event physics on what can be learned about this object through experimental studies. And I mean, I feel a little bit funny about this because what I'm presenting now in terms of results are sort of the apparently the orphans of the analysis in STAR and Phoenix. I mean, none of the STAR and Phoenix speakers have shown their event-by-event results. So I mean, I will now show sort of their unwanted stepchildren. Just a reminder of things that have been proposed by several people on what could be learned from event-by-event physics. I think a lot of some of the authors in the here should recognize their proposals here. And basically, the idea is that event-by-event physics really can tell you a lot about the real object of interest in the field, about the structure and nature of the phase transition between the QGP and the hadronic phase. And I mean, what has been proposed that could be learned was things that are related to chiral symmetry restoration due to the detection of the formation of DCCs. It was proposed that one could learn about something about whether the transition was first or second order by looking for phenomena related to latent heat and related to supercooling, droplet formation. There's the critical point that Misha discussed in detail. And of course, there's the charge fluctuations that Misha also discussed, which could tell us about deconfinement. So basically, at least in theory, it seems that from event-by-event fluctuations of global observables, actually, one could basically learn all about this object that one would ever want to know. And what I will do is basically discuss what we really have learned looking at results on K2-pi fluctuations, mean PT fluctuations, and charge fluctuations. Let me just remind you a little bit on the experimental status. Of course, as I said initially, what I will completely ignore in this talk is a really long history of correlation studies in hadronic and nuclear interactions, intermittency, two-particle correlations, and all sorts of measurements that have characterized the correlation content of nuclear collisions and hadronic collisions. And this I will all ignore and really concentrate on the global measurements that have come up, say, in the last 4 to 5 years. And what you see is that these results from the CERN LED beam were obtained with data that were actually taken around here. So in general, there is a latency of about 4 or 5 years in these results before they come out as final results, which sort of indicates that these are typically not very easy measurements if you want to understand what is really going on. That's the first observation. Second observation is that there really has been a lot of activity in the last year and a half, say, since the last quark matter. And there's definitely much more to come here. Okay, so these are the three things I want to discuss. Let's start with the K to pi ratio. Experimentally, there were very naive questions that one could ask to answer in fluctuations or studying fluctuations of the K to pi ratio. And basically, the two things we want to know is strangeness enhanced in every event, or does the strangeness enhancement of a factor of two only occur in some events, and are other events more similar to what you get from proton-proton, say, in terms of strangeness? This is this question, I think, looking at it in 2002 really seems naive, but it really was a big part of the motivation for building, for example, NE49 the way it was built with this huge time projection chambers. And I'm a little more sophisticated, but still pretty naive, is a question, can we see signs of supercooling by looking at the fluctuations, the K to pi ratio? And just as a reminder, you would expect the K to pi ratio to show some dependence like this on temperature. So if the temperature at which hadronization occurs would vary significantly from event to event, one could expect this to manifest itself in fluctuations of the K to pi ratio. So this were the two motivating factors for this measurement, which was done by NE49. And we used the DDX in the large time projection chambers to identify pions, kaons, and protons. And then using a maximum likelihood fit, we basically stuck all the information that we could get in one event into this maximum likelihood fit to extract exactly one number per event, namely the K to pi ratio, that best fit the data observed for a single event. And that actually required sort of 2 years of a very good student doing nothing else but the detector calibration of the DDX measurement to eliminate the correlation between the observed DDX and the multiplicity or charge that was dumped into the TPC. And I think my guess is, I'm not informed about the internal of STAR, but my guess is that there are also people in STAR going through a similar procedure to make it possible to repeat this measurement in STAR. So this was sort of the procedure for the measurement. And the observed fluctuations are shown here. So this is a distribution. Every entry here is one event. This is the distribution of the K to pi ratio measured for that event, shown as the dots. And this is compared to a statistical reference. In this case, obtained from mixed events. And what you see is that, there's an approximately Gaussian distribution of this fluctuation of the K to pi ratio. And it is very well reproduced by the mixed events. And conclusion from that is that in this case, we don't see dynamical variations. And if you look very closely, you find that the points are not quite on this reference. So the fluctuations that we observed were estimated to be on the order of 2%. And this is actually compatible with what you expect from a resonance gas. And if you have a resonance gas, then there will be slight non-statistical multiplicity fluctuations due to the correlation from the resonance decay, and that, Jeon Koch estimated, gives you a 2% contribution, and that is actually compatible with what we saw here. And what we then concluded from this measurement was that actually strangeness, now in hindsight, not very surprisingly, is enhanced in every event to a very similar degree. And what you can also conclude is that the chemical freeze-out, as a K to pi ratio, is basically the same in every event within statistics. One would also conclude that the freeze-out temperature, say to within plus minus 10% or so, is the same in every event. So we didn't see signs of supercooling, meaning we also didn't see any hint of the system having a large latent heat, which I think will not surprise the lattice people. Okay, this was the K to pi ratio. Now let me come to the next measurement, which was charge fluctuation. So the K to pi ratio sort of dealt with and what is the order of the phase transition? Do we observe a large latent heat? Answer was no. Charge fluctuations deal with the question, what is the net charge per degree of freedom at the moment when the charge fluctuations are then frozen out? And obviously, this net charge per degree of freedom will be very different than whether that occurs in a quark-gluon plasma or in a pion gas. So some relevant measure of these fluctuations was actually predicted to change by a factor of 2 to 4. And the precision in this measurement is on the order of a few percent. So distinguishing between, say, 2 and 4 in this variable should have been really easy. And what one typically does is you can either look at the charge fluctuations in the acceptance of your detector by looking at the difference between positive or negative charges or at their ratio. And there are strong advocates of using either of these two methods. In the end, as you'll see, the conclusion you reach when you do this analysis does not depend on which variable you use. And many of you will probably have seen that the first measurement of this was actually not published from the SPS data by NA49, but from Phoenix a few weeks ago. And that measurement is shown here. So this is charge fluctuations and RIC. So Phoenix has actually here overtaken the analysis that at the SPS, at least in terms of getting it published, or getting it final and submitted for publication. So let me talk you through this plot. What you see here on the vertical axis is the strength of the fluctuations. And they have actually done the measurement both in terms of the ratio and in terms of the difference. And for each of these two measurements of the fluctuations, which are shown as a function of the event centrality, they are comparing the measurements and the points to a reference. And that reference is a pion gas, a gas of a non-interacting pion gas. So it's a gas of particles which have the only characteristic that they have a charge of -1 or +1. And you see that this measurement and the calculation for pion gas actually agree perfectly. The pion gas calculation also gets this peak, which is just an artifact of using a ratio when the multiplicity in the denominator gets very small. And both of these ways of looking at the fluctuations are significantly above the expectations for the quark gluon plasma. And you see the position here is on the order of, in the percent range, and this would be a factor of 2, and clearly this factor of 2 is it's not there in the data. And so the conclusion here was that for gold-gold collisions at 130 GeV, there's no sign of the QGP suppression of charge fluctuations. And this can be compared to results from other experiments. This is the result from NE49 for 3 collision energies. In the lab, it was 40, 80, and 160 GeV, which roughly corresponds to 10 GeV to 18 GeV in the center of mass. This is a measurement of star. And this is, again, the Phoenix measurement as a function of centrality. And one thing that one can see is that first, all of these measurements at all energies agree with the fact that the freeze-out occurs at with fluctuations that resemble a pion gas, or at most the resonance gas, but definitely not the quark gluon plasma. And if one corrects for the acceptance, one actually finds that there's excellent consistency between the star and the Phoenix results. And all the results are essentially flat as a function of centrality. So conclusion on charge fluctuations is fluctuations are very close to the resonance gas prediction. There's little or no energy or centrality dependence, and there's, in this observable, no sign of the QGP.
What you call pion gas is really
resonance. This line here at 4, that's really a pion gas. There's no non-interacting pion gas, no correlations between the particles. Then here at 2.8, that was a prediction of where the full-blown resonance gas should be. And the difference here, this is most likely an artifact and some contribution to this difference between the pion gas and the resonance gas, and that's an artifact of the acceptance of the detector. And Phoenix, they have compared this result to the result they get from ArcGUMD running through a detector simulation, and they find that their result and ArcGUMD agree very well, and then ArcGUMD is a good example of a resonance gas. Okay. So here it seems that, in terms of Mischa's language, diffusion seems to win and wash out or enhance the QGP fluctuations to those expected for the resonance gas. That was done in NA49 seems to suggest that this can also explain the NA49 results. And there's actually one opinion to the contrary I found by Bialas, who argues that if you have quark coalescence as your heteronization mechanism, then the QGP fluctuations actually should not be 2, but 3.3, and then be in rough agreement with the data. But what I gather this week is that the coalescence model is not really in favor with the theorists, and therefore it's unclear how much weight one would put on this. Okay. How much time do you have? Okay, that should be good. PT fluctuations. Now, the appeal of studying global PT fluctuations, of course, was that we think that calculating the mean PT per event, putting it into a histogram, and then taking the width and subtracting one number from it, that sounds very simple. And it's something that you can do with a very high precision. Typically, you can measure the relative widths of this distribution in the per mil range. And so it's a simple observable that, on the other hand, should be sensitive to very many interesting scenarios, from the critical endpoint, DCC production, droplet formation, the behavior of jets. All of that should be visible in PT fluctuations. In general, if you have any correlation between particles that is localized in momentum, then you will be able to see that in fluctuations of the transverse momentum. So it looked simple. And then, of course, if something is not really complicated, you'll find a number of people who find their own ways of trying to quantify the problem. And I think the earliest suggestion on how to numerically characterize the PT fluctuations came from Mark and Moshinsky, whose name I think I misspelled here. I mean, they call their variable phi pt with a definition that is roughly like this. Then there's a variable that Sergei calls sigma squared dynamical, defined like so. And then Tom is advocating something that's called delta sigma squared. And in general, I mean, all of these variables have relatively similar properties. If the fluctuations are completely statistical, then all of these will give you zero. If the fluctuations are not statistical, then all of those will grow quadratically with the strength of the fluctuation, which and for phi pt, that's a bit surprising because the units are MeV, but it still grows quadratically with, temperature, the relative strength of temperature fluctuations or so. So these are three ways of quantifying the pt fluctuations in the data. I mean, my preferred way, or the way I think you have to, if you really want to compare experiments or experiment in theory in detail, is you have to have a direct model comparison. So you have to come up with a model of your fluctuations, run that through the detector simulation, and then run it, compare directly to the data, and do this comparison for different experiments. And if the model describes different experiments, then you know that the results from the experiments are consistent. And as long as you try to describe a complex process like PT fluctuations with a single number, then any comparison will always be qualitative. But I mean, that's the only thing I can do at the moment. I only could take the numbers and compare them. I don't have the means to run this direct model comparison, which was used in the published results by NA49, WA98, and Phoenix. And they all did model comparisons in addition to reporting the numbers. Okay, as I said, today I'll just show the numbers, and what I use is phi pt, just because that's a number that was reported by all the experiments. Okay. So, let me just remind you on the first study that was done in terms of global pt fluctuations, and this was a measurement from NA49. Again, you see here the mean pt calculated event by event. Data are the dots. The black line is the statistical reference, and you see that the dots lie exactly on top of the reference, from which we concluded that if you characterize it in terms of phi pt, that gave a value of 0.6 plus minus 1, consistent with 0. And we concluded that the result was consistent with having only statistical fluctuations and no sign of a dynamical correlation between the particles. One thing that was interesting here is that we actually expect the correlation from HPT, and in the case of this NA49 measurement, that this was canceled by a detector effect. So this is to some extent an artificially low value. There's a 5 MeV contribution from HPT that is taken out here. And for later reference, one has to keep in mind that this measurement was done forward of mid-rapidity, about 1.5 units forward of mid-rapidity. Okay. One thing that is also interesting is that we can not only predict the width of this distribution, but also its exact shape from the inclusive parameters. And that's something that Mike Tannenbaum has pointed out, and what you have to use here is the gamma distribution. Plug in the inclusive parameters and you really can reproduce not only the width, but the shape from the inclusive parameters. Okay. And then, as I showed in my brief history of global fluctuations, there have been lots of new results from STAR and Ceres. I mean, these were first shown at the Quark Matter 2001. And then there's a publication from Phoenix, which appeared on the preprint server a few weeks ago. And again, you see that all of them produce data in that look at first glance very similar to what I've shown before. So you see a statistical reference and then data points that lie relatively close to the statistical reference. You see that the STAR. You see that for this particular measurement, the data points actually lie somewhat outside of the reference, and this difference is something that corresponds to phi pt of 35 MeV, just to give you an idea of how precise you have to do this measurement to get a value of phi pt of 35 MeV. So what I'll try to do in the following is to look at the centrality and energy dependence based on these measurements, the old NA49 measurement and the new preliminary NA49 data. And what I'll do is I'll look at the fluctuations versus two variables. One is collision energy, and obviously what I want to see is whether we see any sign of the critical point there. And the other is I look at it as a function of centrality to see if we can learn something about reaction mechanisms. And the systematics when comparing different experiments, and this is something that Misha explained, so I'll be very brief here. This is not straightforward, because if you have a different acceptance, you'll find that there is a reduction of the observed fluctuation depending on how much of the, say, 2 pi the experiment sees. And you have to correct for that if you want to compare experiments. If you don't do this correction, then what you get is something that looks like this. Here's the Ceres data. This is the new NA49 data. This is the STAR data. This is the published or submitted for publication Phoenix data. And this is the old NA49 data. And obviously, this is a somewhat confusing plot. So it's not obvious that this, and it's not immediately obvious that the experiments agree. But if you do a correction, and this acceptance correction I did by just looking at the relative acceptance of the experiments, and my estimate is that this sort of is good for 25 up to around 25%, then things don't look that confusing anymore. For example, you see that the Phoenix measurement and the STAR measurement actually are completely compatible with each other, but what you see is the Phoenix acceptance is about an eighth or so of the STAR acceptance, and therefore the Phoenix 5PT value that's observed is about an eighth or so of the STAR value for 5PT that is observed. And this, of course, assumes that the correlator for the mechanism that causes the fluctuation is wide compared to the acceptance. And this is an assumption that goes into this correction. So this is, I omitted the Phoenix error bar. I mean, of course, this still extends down to zero, but the central value is completely compatible with what STAR has.
The error bar is huge.
Yeah, it touched zero before, and it will touch zero afterwards also, because if I multiply zero by eight, I still get zero.
But,
yeah. Well, yeah. And then this value is at least to within the precision of my correction. I think the Ceres value and the NA49 value at mid-rapidity at lead at 160 GeV, or 18 GeV is root S actually, are compatible. What remains at zero is the measurement of NA49 that sits forward of mid-rapidity. So if you want to reconcile those, there are two things you have. What you have to assume is that there's a significant rapidity dependence of whatever causes this this value to go so high. And then these are the two other Ceres points. One thing, to give you a scale, what I would like to point out is how sensitive this measurement really is. If you assume that the underlying mechanism, just as a model, is a variation in temperature from event to event, then this line would correspond to a 0.5% variation. This would correspond to a 1% variation, and a 2% variation would be up there. So what we're talking about here is really a very small effect of the order of a 1% variation in temperature from event to event. Okay. And I'm now already moving into the realm of speculation. But if you now take these results, use the known dependence of the barochemical potential on the collision energy, and then translate the results into the MUB, on the MUB axis, what you get is a dependence that looks roughly like this, where this sort of indicates my personal confidence in these numbers. And what I would conclude from that, and of course this conclusion is somewhat speculative, is there is an indication of an energy dependence, and the lower energy Ceres results seem to be significantly lower than say, the STAR result. I have so far not seen the critical point in here, so I think that we can't claim that we've discovered that yet. And to firm up this conclusion, what we really need is the final data from Ceres and NA49 at the lower CERN energies. And what we also want to see, as you heard from Krishna's comment, we want to see the PT dependence which should be the low PT data should be much more sensitive to the critical point. But I think so far we have not seen it. Okay, so in the last couple of minutes, I want to talk about fluctuations versus centrality. And I'll start from these two sets of data. This is NA49 data. Here is the mid-rapidity point, here the forward rapidity point, and shown as a function of the number of participants. This is lead-lead data, this is silicon-silicon, this is carbon-carbon, and this is proton-proton. So from here to there, we span the full range of number of participants from proton-proton to central lead-lead. And this is similar data from STAR, now measured at delta phi, delta sigma squared, but this is very similar to phi PT, so one can essentially directly compare them with the precision I'm aiming for now. And again, you span here almost the full range in the number of participants, but of course, the precise number of participants at this very peripheral values, this is, it doesn't have more than a 50% error, but I think the uncertainty is not much smaller than 50%. And now what we would like to see is if there's if there's sort of a common trend between these two energies. So what I did here, I sort of undivided this data from the estimated PP point and then plot them on the same axis. And then what it looks like is sort of like this. And basically in both data sets, what seems to happen is that you get a relatively rapid rise from low number of participants up to say around 100, and then some kind of saturation both at the SPS and at RIC. And something that Tom suggests is to plot this as a function of number of participants to the 1/3, so the length of the length of the material the incoming particles have to traverse. And then you see that within all the uncertainties that I've mentioned, you get a somewhat possibly linear rise and then a saturation. And there are lots of experimental difficulties involved here. I will be happy to elaborate on that, but that's what the most naive look at the data gives you. And then what you can argue then is that this is reminiscent of the result of initial state scattering in the nucleus, where you would expect that you get a contribution to, and you essentially have a random walk in the transverse dimension here, which gives you a boost of the final particle source in the transverse direction, sort of the standard explanation of the Cronin effect. And that something like this would suggest a rise in this fluctuations as you go as the incoming particles go through more and more matter before the final particle production occurs. And that this is something that Tom was speculating, but it's also something that Mark, Andrei Leonidov, and I looked at many years ago, inspired by a model by Helmut. I'm not sure if he actually remembers that that paper. But he looked at a random walk in transverse rapidity as an explanation for the observed radial flow at CERN. Basically, if you take this model and calculate the event-by-event fluctuations in PT from that model, you find that you get, as the thickness you traverse increases, you find that you get a significant increase in the transverse momentum fluctuations. Okay. And of course, this structure of a rapid rise and then the saturation is somewhat reminiscent of what happens with the average transverse momentum as you increase the number of participants, which rises rapidly and then levels off. And I think it would be interesting to find out whether there's any connection between these two phenomena, which both happen in transverse momentum space. And maybe I'll just conclude with this. What I think will be very interesting to do both at CERN and at RIC is to study transverse momentum fluctuations in PA data as a function of centrality and see if there's a common connection between the structure you see in the increase in fluctuations and the increase in mean transverse momentum. And then the next point is obviously you want to look at more differential measures, not just averaging over all particles, but looking at least separately at low and high PT, and then also at two-particle correlators. Okay, so that's it.
So, related to this question of whether they're at low PT or high PT, one of the things that occurred to me after Peter Jacobs' talk, is Peter in the room? So right behind me, is that the fact that STAR is starting to see that bump in Peter's plot, which was a sign of jettiness, speaking loosely. If there's jettiness in the final state, then at least some of the phi PT, I mean, I don't know how much, but some of the PT, some phi PT will come from that and will be at quite high PT. I don't know how much. I have no idea how much.
No, I mean, actually, I mean, that...
Because that jettiness was at PT 14. That was 5 orders of magnitude.
Right, but...
Can I answer?
I haven't finished the question yet.
Okay.
My suggestion is I just want to reiterate the importance of just splitting the data in half in PT. This is not something, Edward may be right, but it doesn't matter. It's for the experimentalist to answer. Split it in half in PT and see whether the fluctuations are at high PT, in which case they're interesting. And they're interesting in one sense. Maybe they have to do with jettiness. Maybe they have to do with, they're interesting in one sense. Or if they're at low PT, then they might have something to do with their critical point. But it's clear that if they're either flat across all PT or dominated at high PT, then they have nothing to do with their critical point. And this is why it's important to do this analysis. That was the comment.
So maybe I can comment on your comment. And that's, several years ago, Marek, Andrei Leonidov and I started an investigation of several event generators for RIC and the LHC, looking at how switching on and off hard scattering in these event generators influenced phi PT. And for the LHC, if you took... I unfortunately never wrote that up, so now I have to quote from memory, but for certain event generators, you could get phi PT values in the range of several hundred MeV. So temperature fluctuations in the few percent range based on whether you did or did not switch off their implementation of what the jets look like. So I think this
was at LHC.
This was at LHC. At RIC, the numbers were somewhat lower, but still comparable to actually what we see here. So that was integrating 5PT over relatively low transverse momenta of, say, up to 2 GeV. So I think this is potentially sensitive to things like this.
Okay, so I would be curious to learn the fate of another fluctuation idea that was floating around, which was also connected to jettiness, that I don't know how widely it was circulated, but it was the idea of fluctuations in azimuthal anisotropy. The idea was you look at, you can calculate an event-by-event variable, which is the Fourier moment in azimuthal space, and the idea is the fluctuations would be related to the number of particles. So if all the particles were just final state particles in some sort of thermal idea, you'd get one size of fluctuations. But if they were clumped by mini jets, if they were produced by mini jets, then the statistics would be different and the fluctuations would be different. So you could identify the number of sort of independent, phi independent objects by looking at the fluctuations in the Fourier moments.
I mean, I know that Art Postkanzer was starting to look at that in EDIT-49 data. But then I guess he got cut off by the RIC data coming in, and I would assume that this measurement is now going to be done by STAR, and maybe Peter will also. The slight difficulty there is, I have to again find an appropriate variable for that, and I think there's about the same number of candidates as there are for...
No, I think the event-by-event Fourier moments are very well defined, and they can be explained easily, and they do contain the information, so...
Yeah, but you still have to extract the sort of statistical, and you have to split what you see into a statistical and...
That's easy. It works well in those variables.
It also looked easy in PT before we really started doing it.
But I understand.
Okay.
We'll see when it's done. Anyway.
Thank you. very simple idea on which no real calculations have been made, but there were some analysis that if you speak about average PT particle, just the typical one, and we see a difference between SPS data and RIG data, and RIG data are somewhat higher. So in other words, what I would suspect is that there is a fluctuation in the flow, because flow determines the slope of PT distribution. So how you check it? You check it in the following way, that in the strainer plot, when you have one PT versus the other PT, the change of slope means that at when both PTs are small, if you have a this is it, yes, that you have negative and positive correlation on two ends, etc. And something like that, I believe, was observed. So, in other words, if you look not on global observable but on this trainer type plot, you see more, and you see the pattern whether. You know, whether it is a fluctuation of a slope of a spectrum for all particles or not, yes?
Yeah, I mean, I agree that in principle this carries more information. The reason I didn't mention it was that in my talk in Seattle in January, I spent half of my 40 minutes trying to explain what these funny squares were, so I didn't go into this today. But in principle, there is more information that can be obtained by looking at the two-particle correlators directly.
Just a brief comment to Krishna. A jet has finite correlation length in pseudo rapidity, so perhaps a way to isolate the fluctuations specific to jettiness is to look at correlations as a function of pseudo rapidity interval. That's in fact how we isolated the jet-like correlations that you saw in my talk. So that's the degree of freedom one could exploit to really isolate that.
Yeah, I mean, I think STAR has a big advantage than NA49. You know, the acceptance, the relative acceptance changes as a function of PT changes depending on where you are in rapidity. So there, I think we're out of luck.
Yeah, so along with that jettiness, if there's significant jettiness, it will contribute to PT at some level, whether we like it or not. And you can find it. You can find it in PT just by getting into PT.
There you go. Right.
I may have missed it during your talk, but do you understand why the phi variable depends on rapidity, why it goes down at forward rapidity?
I think the simple answer is no. I mean, I don't understand it. And I mean, the changes and our upper limit that we set on fluctuations for based on that result was 0.5%. What we see at mid rapidity is around 1%. So you would have to have a process where the sort of relative PT or temperature fluctuation changes from 1% to 0.5% over about one unit in rapidity, which isn't doesn't look completely crazy. But unless somebody comes up with a model for what happens at mid rapidity, I can't test whether that's compatible with what we see at forward rapidity. But I have no clear example for such a mechanism. On the other hand, if it's somehow related to initial state scattering and hard processes, I think that would localize it more at mid rapidity, but that's wild speculation as opposed to mild speculation.
I mean, when one looks at these results, one is struck by the fact that the limits set on fluctuations of thermodynamical quantities, like the temperature, become incredibly small. I mean, as you demonstrate, 2% is already way off scale in here. So, on the other hand, if you take this literally, and you interpret this temperature, which you see in, say, mean PT fluctuations as the thermal freeze-out temperature, and you have 120 MeV, say, and you take a 2% error bar, that's 2 MeV. What I cannot reconcile with that is that if I talk with our event generator friends, like Stefan Barst and others, they keep on insisting that thermal freeze-out takes place not instantaneously, but there is emission from the system over a certain period of time, and how can one reconcile such precise limits on temperature fluctuations with what you obtain in such a system?
Well, I mean, somewhat hard to visualize is, I mean, how does 2% dynamical variation and the somewhat bigger underlying statistical fluctuation correspond to what our Urkund Deos or friends are talking about. And the other thing is that I think in general we have seen many examples that when you talk about hadronization timescale, and the event generators all have problems with that. So it's maybe hard to reconcile with the event generators. It may not be so hard to reconcile with other aspects of the data.
Okay, so we have to limit the number of questions to the break. The first one is ask if anyone who has not asked the question, I'm leaving. Well, now I want to have the last chance. One, two, go. So now we have the last question of the conference.
This is not going to be the last question. I'm sure there'll be lots of questions during the roundtable. Comment to Peter, and then the question I was going to ask Gunther. I mean, event generators are designed to describe average quantities. I don't think you can draw a lot of conclusions from the fluctuations from the event generators. Okay, I wouldn't. But my question for Gunther is, in the rapidity dependence with NA49, suppose that you, do you have any idea what the difference in mu's is between, you know, the central rapidity and whatever forward rapidity you were at with the point where it's zero?
Well, I mean, mu for the central rapidity is 250.
Right. Now, and how much? The question is, how much bigger is mu at forward rapidity? It'll be bigger just because there'll be more baryon number at forward rapidity.
Okay, I don't have.
It's not by a lot. That's what
I
I'm asking.
I don't think it's
just 400.
Yeah, I mean, it won't take you. I mean, it won't take you. It won't take you out of this range. I get my guess is it's somewhere. Well, as Uli said, it would be somewhere around here, but. Would be easy to calculate, but I don't have the antiproton rapidity distribution in my head.
So the two should be there in my opinion.
Yeah.